Well, welcome back to part two of our interview on the career of the only man to ever be Speaker of the House and President of the Senate, Senator Ron Richard. Thank you so much for having us here at 4th Street Bowl in Joplin.
Well, it's my pleasure. I hope you enjoy yourself in our little abode, but we're very proud of it.
So from this office, you were working, and then you ran for state representative. Pretty easy race. I guess after being mayor, you probably thought you had to be the favorite, right?
Yes. But when I lost that race to Marvin Singleton 4 years before, I figured that a little more hard work, a little more political nuances and would help. And so I changed some strategy and campaign and how to spend money and raise money, and it worked ever since.
So you come in as part of the biggest class, biggest freshman class ever.
Yeah, 96, 97, 94, whatever it was. Yeah,
and brought the majority.
Did. Yeah, that was...
Where were you at that night, on election night, when you found out you would be the majority? Were you here? Did you go to the central party?
I was at home, and I didn't know that, and I think either Rod Jettner, Jason Crowell, because they was calling around Richard Byrd, and Jason Crowell was calling around trying to get the votes from the majority leader. And that's when I found out, because I didn't know. I mean, I just didn't think about it. A majority coming in that heavy, but
things are quiet. But where'd you come down on that?
On what?
On that leadership race.
I voted for Jason Crowell.
It's a funny thing how those leadership races. I think folks vote in them and then sometimes want to have their marble back at times. You know.
Nah, Crowell was. I mean, he was intense. So he's more intense than I was. But Richard Byrd.
Did you learn something from that though? You won a lot of leadership races.
Yeah, there's a time to pull back a little bit, but Jason's very smart. He was the right guy at the right time. Richard Byrd went to judiciary chair,
yep.
Right guy at the right time. I mean, it all worked out. Hannaway and Jettin had a unique way of putting people in the right spot that shepherded us along. And, you know, Richard Byrd, he was
brilliant.
And he still, we're finding some things in legislation no one knew there.
I remember back in the day when the Republicans first took over, it'd been decades. Nobody knew how to run the chamber.
50 years, yeah.
One knew. It took.
We didn't know.
Crowell would get twisted. I remember the Democrats, Villa, Representative Villa, tie things up with the rules. And
well, he did, but then after a fashion, when I was just jumping ahead, when I was bigger, he'd come up and coach me on how to work the rules and stuff. And Tom and I have been very friends. Matter of fact, he and I send ornery little notes back and forth to each other for years. I remember the day, though, we walked in that chamber. And I looked up in that ceiling, and I think that was the day I fell in love with the Capitol, of all the artwork and the traditions and then trying to make it better. And then I thought, now what do I do? All these people, majority, we don't know the rules, we don't know, but we learned. We learned, made a few mistakes, we learned.
You come in with that big class. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of those folks want to be in leadership too, right?
At what point everybody in the building must be in leadership, yeah.
So not much to go off of. There was no freshman class of Republicans in the majority for 50 years. What does a person do that gets elected? I mean, there's going to be a huge freshman class this year, that same turnover. What do you do to start trying to set yourself apart and run? Not even to run for leadership. What do you just do to succeed and kind of stand out?
Yeah, I never really cared about standing out, and I never thought of running leadership. What I tried to do is understanding that it took 82 to pass anything. I mean, I could figure that one out.
Mm-hmm.
And circle yourselves with good people, people that are smart, that have a vision, that even though I'm not sure you agree with all the time, but that's what I did. I mean, I had Steve Hobbs, a farmer in Mexico, Watson next to me, Mike Cunningham from Webster, David Sater. I mean, I can go through all of them. They're still very close friends of mine. I just and then at night, they'd all come to Mark Bruns and Hobbs and my office, and we'd sit around Byrd, and it must have been 40 of us every night, and talk about what happened in each committee, because it was so big, we could never get to all of them. And so guys like Richard Byrd explained to us what's going on in the judiciary, and Hobbs would talk about the farming, and Munslinger and those guys would explain you just couldn't be everywhere. So that's what we did. And then that group of 30 or 40 transcended into a group of 70 or 80. And that started kind of my networking to, didn't think it was going to do any further than that. But it was just a survival, I guess, try to figure out what was going on. Because when you make a vote out there, 163, you want to make sure you make a right vote.
So a couple of these issues, Medicaid reform, I remember was a huge thing.
Oh, yeah.
That didn't. I always thought it was an interesting thing. I think Jay Nixon is a statesman, and he campaigned on restoring those cuts.
Yeah.
But he never did that. And I think he also liked that AAA credit rating. Could you have that if you hadn't made those tough choices back then?
Well, Matt Blount's the first one that cut Medicaid. And we, when I was Speaker, and we cut Medicaid by one vote in the House. And that was tough because I had Charlie Shields and a bunch of senators over there just giving me the dickens about how this ought to go another way. And I said, my guys just don't want to do this. They think it's just not right. We need some other reforms and stuff. So, and we lost. Or we won that, but one vote. It depends on what side you're on. But
talk about tort reform. That's something that has been part of EcoDevo and was done under Governor Blount while you were in the House.
Yeah, we had a tort reform bill, the first one that Richard Byrd did, and we're talking about caps on what the reforms are going to be, and how much doctors could be capped, that lawyers could get when they sue a doctor, and medical malpractice caps. And we walked into the Benton Gallery, and Jetton walked to me and said, you're on that conference committee. I said, I've never been on a conference committee. What do you do? He said, you know what to do. So we walked in there, Richard Byrd's chair, and we voted. And Brian Pratt, who was turns out to be my speaker pro temp, voted against tort reform. And Crowell and Jetton about had a coronary, yanked him off of there, took him in there and gave him a tongue lash. Went back in there, had to go back out, go through all the motions again, and I was deciding vote on that year. Other Republican, Charlie Wheeler, was the old mayor. He voted with us. Yeah. He's an old doctor. And, of course, those have been modified since then, the courts and stuff, and we're going to have to go back and address that at some point in time. But, yeah, I was there. I was deciding vote on that when we did it the first time.
So talk about workers' comp. That's another thing that came through.
Yeah, I wasn't as much involved in that as others have. I mean, I was just a solid vote other than, you know, knowing what workers' comp premiums are around here and it was going out of sight. And I was just on the sidelines pushing my members. We did workers' comp in the House and Senate and pushing members to vote and follow the chairman. So I took a seat to just get the votes.
There was another part in there that's changed some things, and it's changed back recently, but you eliminated the limits on campaign donations. They were very low back in the day.
$300 or $350, and $500 for, they wouldn't
something like that, yeah.
Still had plenty of money to run on campaigns. I still raised, Tilly and I, when we were doing that, he was majority leader, we still raised a lot of money. I mean, you had PACs, and you could go around and get unlimited different ways, but, I mean, it's still, you could fund campaigns back on that thing.
You know, it looked to me back in the day, I worked on campaigns for a while leading up to that under that old system, there would be 50 PACs and the legislative and judicials and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And it was the money was roughly maybe a little bit bigger now, but inflation may be the same. But it sure wasn't as transparent as if somebody gives a check, they just generally give it to the person.
Yeah, I've always been a proponent of give whatever you want based on that Supreme Court ruling. But you have to report it within 24 hours. And I don't care if you give a dollar or $5 million, then people know where it came from. They can make a decision. Even now with this campaign law, I mean, it's cumbersome. Money's going to find a way. Now you got PACs to PACs. You don't know who belongs to PAC. It's not going to get the job done. It should have been.
There was criticism, but I think history may have shown that was, there's no perfect way, but unlimited donations to a person, that looks pretty wise looking back, I think.
Well, it's still, as your words, transparent. At least you know. Yeah. And if you want to penalize someone for taking an unlimited amount of money, then, you know, you could. Term limits every 2 years in the House. That's why, even though I was a proponent of term limits, sometimes I'm wondering if if that's the best case. But looking at the Fed, maybe term limits are a good idea. Without term limits, I'd have never had a chance.
So economic development is, when I talk to folks, that's one thing they would say, that he cares. His motives, they said that Matt Blunt put it, that you don't question his motives about jobs because you know he truly cares. It's not personal. It's not his bill. Where did the passion for economic development come? Is it just from owning a business, or?
Well, it's from seeing unemployed people. It's from seeing people that maybe not had a chance to do exactly what their dream was. Matt put me in a position to do. We traveled the world together promoting business. He was a good governor. I think it was anything else I just involved in, just intense, and it's the same issue than when I was mayor. It was trying to get people. I always thought the big piece of pie would grow. The more people went to work, the better they were trained, they'd make more money, and then because the pie grew, education do better, social services do better, and maybe that's a simplistic view, but that was always my vision, and I understood what the issues are on creating jobs and keeping people. I mean, you can't do much about the economy and stuff on the Fed and stock market, yeah. But I thought if we were diversified in Missouri, that it'd go a long way.
Well, the Quality Jobs Act, that was your bill. That's been used in every big expansion since.
It was mine and John Griesheimer. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember if Griesheimer's bill will pass this, because I remember going to him, and neither one of us cared who got the credit. We said, this thing needs to pass, and it could have been him. I don't remember. All I knew is I was hustling the votes for it, and yeah. He was hustling the votes to the Senate. I still don't know whose bill it was. But
it's an amazing thing. If you look at almost every major jobs expansion, some part of that law is used.
Yeah, Missouri Works is now. Yeah, that was our foundation for going forward. I mean, when we attracted Ford in Kansas City, Clay Como, we used that, and we went in special session on that. I remember Governor Nixon called us in and had to whip some votes on that thing, and as it turned out, I mean, what a great opportunity that was for Kansas City. I mean, I think there must be around 8,000 people up there working
now. Yeah, still today.
Yeah.
There's a story I got told from Rodney Boyd.
Uh-oh.
And he said he got to know you because he was in Hobbs's office and you were a seatmate with him or in the same office.
Yeah.
And he got to know you a little bit, and he found out about some of your ties to St. Louis, and you kept that. You would always ask, what do you do to grow jobs? Well, there's one thing, it wasn't really about economic development directly. He talked about how one time you helped save drug courts, not just in St. Louis, but statewide.
Well, the Supreme Court Chief Justice back then, Ray Price, that was one of his big issues of drug court. And the administration or previous speaker at the House didn't fund drug courts. And I said, well, I'm just going to go see what it's all about. So I went to St. Louis and visited drug courts in St. Louis. And they even asked me to speak to them as the graduates. And it appeared to me that it had such a benefit. People were changing their lives. So I came back. We threw some money at it. Then I came back and spoke again, because I couldn't get anybody from St. Louis to go speak at drug courts in downtown St. Louis. And then I became pretty good friends with Francis Slade. I said, I'm from St. Louis, I mean, but my city is at the other end of I-44, and if you guys do good, I'm going to do good. What is it? I mean, you guys are losing corporate. What is it we need to do to kickstart St. Louis? And that's when we started with Express Scripts, and I tried to figure a way to save Hazelwood Ford plant. And you know, people think I'm against unions. I mean, I probably put more union people to work than anybody.
Well, Clay Como's fully union, right?
Yeah, and then we kept Hazelwood long enough, those guys retire. We took out $1 billion package out to Fenton, and when he was trying to keep Chrysler out there, when he was going to co-mingle with Volkswagen, and for whatever reason, I don't know, they didn't work, and they went to Chattanooga, but, and then what we did for downtown on that GEO special.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't really care what kind of jobs you are. We know that needs to stay in St. Louis, and thank goodness it came together, Democrats, Republicans, because we had a tough time against Illinois because they wanted to go out there to the fort outside.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. I mean, I had to watch the Clay Como thing from the cheap seats, And, you know, Republicans talk about how, you know, no incentives or corporate world, or whatever buzzword when they're campaigning. But in the real world, you have to do something to attract those jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, is it...
It's a competition demands.
Ideology can get bankrupt just sometimes.
Yeah.
It looks to me like.
Yeah, you can't get in the way of yourself. I mean, I remember Will Krause was on economic development. I said, Will, we're going to special session. I need to know in a tie vote, I got to get that Ford out. He said he couldn't vote for it. I pulled him off. We got the thing in, and then I put it back on. I had to, there was no tie. I put it back on. I found it wasn't a tie. That's how serious it was, making sure we got that thing out to the floor of the House.
Do you think sometimes Republicans, and I'm sure Democrats from the other perspective, but the ideology taken to the extreme just shoot yourself in the foot almost. They don't look at numbers.
I think that's why I've gotten along. I mean, you know, Gina Walsh and I are fast friends too, but we work through issues, and this last session or two has been a pretty good example. I didn't have to move the previous question on some of those things. No, I take pride in being able to work with a lot of different people, both sides of the building, and I think Missouri is better off in job creation, job retention than we've ever been. And I think, I'm hopeful for the future. I hope it keeps continuing.
There's a name that some folks recently might not know well, but back when you were in the House was well known. That's Lance Beshore.
Oh, yeah.
Liggett and Platt. He was always a very big promoter of yours. What? How'd that relationship start, and can you tell us a little bit?
Well, he was on the National Committee for many years. And I knew him from... Liggett and Platt, Harry Cornell was always big in politics. He was a big Bill Webster supporter back in the 90s for governor when he was attorney general. And they were very much in politics. And I went over to him one day when I was running as Marvin, and I asked for his help. He said, "Nah, it's not your time. We don't help running against incumbents. Marvin may not be the best, but he's ours. Come back." And that's probably the best advice I got. I said, "Thank you." And I came back, and he's helped me ever since. But he did help me that time. He said, "You're a little too early on this thing."
Well, it sounds like he talked to him about like you talked to other people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
direct, honest, you know, just straight up.
How do you not deal with something that's not forthright? And if I have to apologize for being forthright sometimes, maybe I'm a little bit over the top sometimes.
So you run for speaker designee. Now, this is the first time that ever happened, right? Normally, at the caucus after the election, the Republicans get together and pick. The former speaker, Rod Jetton, come up with a way to have somebody, about a year early, was it, back in the day? So you run against the sitting budget chair, Alan Isett.
Yeah, he wasn't budget chair then. I think Brad Lauger was.
Well, Brad had got removed, and Alan,
maybe he
however
was.
It works.
Maybe it was. He was. That's right. He might have got moved up. That's probably right, yeah.
And so I think people forget that was probably one of the most contentious speaker races that they've seen since they had the majority, right?
I didn't think so at the time, but I had the votes. It was urban against rural, what it was.
Yeah.
But I had a plan is based on Roman legions. I had a dirty dozen of 24 people that were supposed to watch, that get three people or four, and they were responsible for them. So they would check with them and make sure we're solid after we...
Do you have this in a notebook written down?
Or? No, I did it right in my brain. So I got a dirty dozen. They have
so
their two or three...
Hobbs, Cunningham...
Wasson. I mean...
What happened?
Everybody, Munslinger, I mean... All the rules.
Pierce,
David,
back in the day.
David Pierce.
Carson, one of them?
He wasn't there yet.
Okay.
He was there after I was speaker. Tilly, we had them all, and I won. Wasson was my counter, and he said we won by about 8 or 9 votes. I mean, so I guess some people didn't tell me the truth, but go figure.
Yeah.
But, you know, you win. And then that day, we're still in the chamber. And I just said, "I'm going to point Alan Isett, budget chair," and to this day, he was, a really strong budget chair. And we had strong personalities in the Senate, but Alan could match up.
And you had to do some cutting that year, right?
Oh yeah,
So, you know, to me, do you think because you did it that day, it's in a signal you weren't going to hold grudges, you can do what's best for the caucus and the state?
No, I never did hold a grudge. I mean, you know, you...
But other people might not have been able to know that. Do you think that sent a signal of how you're going to handle things?
Well, that was the intention. Yeah. We were Alan and I one day, I'll tell you a story about Metro. Bob Bear was running Metro. You know Bob Bear?
I know who he is.
He'd passed away. He walked in with tears in his eyes and said, you know, we've been cut. I don't have enough money to run. We got people going to work on Metro, black, white, brown, everybody, and we need a little extra help so we can get people to work. Alan and I, we got an urban guy and a rural guy, put $10 million in the budget for Metro when nobody thought it was cool and talked to the Senate and got that done, trying to get people to go to work. That's how Alan and I felt about putting people to work.
So is the speaker designee a good way to do that? Do you think that's the right way, or should they just do it after the election, just side up and vote?
Yeah. Well, there are
does it help?
Two thoughts. I mean, Rod had the vision that he thought somebody ought to know exactly how the system works and to get ready for it. I'm not all that convinced. I mean, it puts a lot of pressure. Well, here's what happens. You're a speaker for 2 years. The first year, okay. The second year, once the speaker delegate in waiting, all the lobbying corps, all the movement about February goes to that office. Well, it's hard to negotiate when they're not ready to negotiate. So you have to hope you have a speaker after you that's willing to work with you. And I was lucky. Steve and I had a good relationship. And I don't remember who Steve's majority leader was. I think it was for his too. And then I was not involved in House after that.
If you were given a piece of advice to Elijah Haar, would you tell him to have a speaker designee? Now they do it way up in the fall.
So. Yeah, I am. I mean, they got 112, 140. Maybe they need to now. I don't know. I don't want to pre-guess what they need to do in the House. We did it our way. We worked. We passed a lot of good stuff. Didn't pass a lot of stuff. I mean, we never did count numbers. But I think we increased majority over time.
I want to ask you about that. In 2008, you were the speaker designee. You went out in a bad year for Republicans, a year that the president's nominee barely won. You
horrible.
Actually gained seats, one of the only Republican caucuses in the country.
We were lucky to survive. I mean, when the Obama landslide was going on, I mean, that was tough. I mean, Steve Taylor was out recruiting. I was out raising money. No Dell was out working. And I don't know how that worked. I guess we just outworked everybody. I don't know.
Tell folks about Robert Nodell.
He may be one of the best political minds. He helped us save the majority of that 2008. Hadn't been for him out on the road. Steve recruiting. I'm raising money. Along with all, and Nodell out getting us good quality candidates. I can't compliment all of them, but that 2008, how we kept the majority, I don't know.
So when you're sitting back and you've got X races to win, X competitive ones, what is that like to put together a plan to fund an entire HRCC operation?
It's horrible. Because some people can't raise money, don't want to, don't know how, and spend it in ways that's not necessarily the best, don't know how to spend it on polling, don't know right vendors. We had to do all that, Nodell and I, and Tilly, we all had to do that. So we made it work. We made it work.
Just back in the day, you just wear your car out, ask people for money? Is that just
that's hard work?
That's
right, face to face, yeah. And told them what I was going to do, what we can do, what we will do, and what we can't do. And I asked for their help. And then the ones that helped, I kept them in the game. I asked him, how are we doing? What do you think needs to be modified? Because some people, well, we're such a new majority, people didn't know how we're going to act. We went to Jeff City going back when we were first elected. We had a meeting at the Coca-Cola plant right across the street there on Whitten, and all the members, new mayor, Democrat, Republican, and I'll never forget, it was like a gauntlet. All the lobbyists were looking at us and, who's that? Who's that? Is he there? I mean, it's almost humorous.
A little cattle call almost?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and especially the lobbying corps was on their heels anyway because they were entrenched on the other side of the aisle, and all of a sudden they're going, now we got to adjust our, and we knew who our friends were and who they weren't, and that. it was adjustment time. So
you never kept your campaign money. You gave it away most of the time, most all the time, really, right?
Yeah, I think I've got 70 or 80. I always had $1 million or $2 million. Yeah, I gave it all to candidates or gave it to polling.
To be a businessman, I don't think anybody's ever gave away as much money in Missouri as you have.
No, I don't. Probably not. I've raised.
Yeah, I think that's. I did a little math on that. I think that's right.
Yeah, and I'm going to give away whatever I have left. If I don't give it to campaigns, whatever, I'll give it away. I don't need to have a pack or have something. I mean, when I'm going, I'm going. I'm not going to do that. But yeah, I've been fortunate. I don't know how many millions I've raised, but I've given it all away for candidates.
So I thought it was an interesting thing. Even in the Senate, you yourself, Senator Wasson, and Senator Cunningham now, are some of the last people that ever served with people that served in the minority. And you know what that thin majority in 06 was like.
Well, we never served the minority.
But you served with some people that had.
Oh, yeah.
You actually had a little
Munslinger,
Catherine,
yeah.
She had served in the minority.
Oh, yeah. She was minority leader, yeah.
And you'd actually, while you weren't in the minority, you'd serve with people that were.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And do you think that gives do you think you have a perspective that the folks coming back next year won't, except Senator Cunningham, that you're not birthed, the Republicans aren't entitled by God's law to be the majority party?
No. I tell them all the time, sooner or later you'll be on the first floor. Everybody. And that's why I started getting involved in those mezzanines in the House. I mean, what a horrible spot. I mean, I was with a number of House guys, Gary Burton, Mark Elliott, Chuck Surface.
You were in the mezzanine?
They were, and I'd go visit them.
Yeah.
And I thought, what a horrible place for these people to be and making a difference if what side of the aisle you are. And that started my thinking about this whole remodeling the Capitol. And I just did it one little at a time. I mean, when I was Speaker, the first thing I did is tear up the carpet and then look at the hardwoods and had them redone. And that started. Now it's a trend of doing almost all the Senate offices and many of the House. I mean, and then that got, I was talking to Bob Priddy and figured out what I can do to help the Capitol. I'm trying to get, and Parsons did the bonding bill, and now you can see what's going on. I mean, we've been trying to enhance that. We had mold, water infiltration from the sides, and the place is horrible. It's going to fall over. Someone didn't pay attention.
So you're most known. I mean, there's scaffolding all over the Capitol right now.
Yes.
I don't think there's a person in the Capitol that doesn't attribute that to you. You were talking about raising money and doing this the whole time I knew you were in leadership. Why do you think the Capitol never, I mean, it almost is a little bit of a shame on the folks that ran it not to do anything to maintain it.
Out of sight, out of mind, I guess. They figured it'd be there forever, but.
Well, it really could have fell in on itself.
Well, it would have. There's that water infiltration was doing some of the foundation, and the dome was water coming in. Yeah, it, but thank goodness we're going to make it a little bit better.
Are you proud of that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's something everybody can. And, you know, when you walk in there, you know, what a great place to go to work. Mark Elliott always, I said, Mark, what do you think about the building? He said, well, you know, I used to get pitter-patter when I'd go to the Capitol, and now I'm getting pitter-patter when I see it in the rearview mirror when he was term limit out, and I thought that was kind of funny. I haven't got that pitter-patter in my rearview mirror yet, but I tell you, even 16 years, you walk in there, and if you just look at that artwork, and I used to stop the House whenever there was a contentious debate, and give a history lesson, pull out a book and read up to what those murals are and do that. And people thought I was a little bit nutty on that and stuff, but maybe.
Is that something you'll come back to Jeff City for when they get the Capitol done?
Yeah, probably so. Yeah, I'd like to see how that turns out.
I mean, there may be somebody's name on the plaque or something, but I think it's not just my opinion. I think that's pretty well accepted that if you hadn't decided to make that your issue and push it, it would not have happened.
Well, you know, I don't know about that, but it takes 82 to do anything and 18 to do anything. So, you know, I had 17 and 81 that thought the same way, so credit goes to everybody.
So you become Speaker. Yeah. There's a couple interesting things about being Speaker. There's a lot of interesting about being Speaker, but one that a lot of people I talk to would mention back to me, Senator Cunningham mentioned this and a few others, is you had a lot of people that had helped you. I had a list of you know, Parson, Pierce, Hobbs, Bruns, Wasson, Cunningham, I know there were more. They were chairmen, and you dealt with chairmen, and it seems like you gave them a lot of latitude to make decisions.
I gave them a lot of power, and I did that in the Senate, too. We'll start with Brian Munslinger when he did ag. I had a number of people that I was moving around, and some people I didn't trust too well. I had Munslinger on eight committees one time. I pulled someone on Monday on your own committee. He has an eight. Now you do eight committees. I have not, but he did it. Mike Parsons traveled with me when we were recruiting over in the Boot Hill, and he was chair of rules when I was speaker. And I had a rules chairman that was having a tough time with his health, and is an education bill, and I thought it just needed to be tweaked. And Parsons, he always walked by the dais and look up at me, and he said, "You asked for it," which I'm reminding him now. He asked for it, and he knows what I'm doing. So I said, "Parsons, you've got a real issue coming here." He said, "What's that?" I said, "You know that education bill you're doing? You're going to rewrite it." He said, "I don't know anything about that." I said, "You're going to learn, because that thing needs tweaked." He mastered one of the last education bills up to a couple of years ago in the House, in the Rules Committee. He did that. No
Rules
one knows
Committee
a
good innovation? That was something that came in when you was in the House.
Nah, I'd get rid of that thing in a heartbeat. That's just another way for the Speaker to buffer himself, not make a tough decision. I'd rather have those decisions in there. I wouldn't have a Rules Committee.
Yeah. I'm not sure you're the people that remember prior to.
No. All that.
Do you think part of that, though, was the Republicans didn't know what they really had to do this, and so they were trying to come up with some safeguards as they learned to govern?
I think some speakers want some buffer. They had a steering committees on point and members committees. They had the rules committee. And they had people that was, Shannon Cooper. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was pretty good rules chair, but but it was a speaker's committee.
It was the buffer, yeah. No, it was, yeah.
And I just thought, what a waste of time.
So, Dylan, I'm going to ask you this question from the other side. You're the only person that can give a perspective of both. I always thought one of the main jobs of the speaker was to negotiate with the Senate, to either, however you do that negotiation, be it friendly, unfriendly. What advice would you give to an Elijah Haar about dealing with the Senate or his predecessor or his successors?
Well, I mean, you need to try, because you have that, and you need to encourage. Sometimes it doesn't need to be the speaker and the pro tem, it's chairman. And you encourage those guys to go back and forth, because you can't oversee everything. And if you got a good chairman, you insist that they work with their counterpart, you can get a lot of things done. Now, when it comes to final negotiations, I relied on majority leaders to deal with each other. But when I dealt with, I had a great relationship with Gibbons and Shields, and then when Todd Richardson, John Deal. I mean, I never had any issues with any of them. We always had when Steve was there, Speaker, and Tim Jones. I just never had any problem. I mean, of course, we served together, all those guys. I think even if you can't get your chairman, they'll work it out. That's where the power ought to be anyway, and all the chairman on both sides.
When you're the Speaker, how do you deal with the governor? You dealt with the governor as Speaker of the opposite party for a while. You were in leadership and you saw one of your own party.
I mean, you have to understand he's going to sign it or not. It's helpful to have a governor that wants to be engaged, and then when you have a governor that wasn't engaged because of a lot of noise this last couple months, it really empowered the legislature to do what they do. I mean, we had the best session we had on the House Senate because the majority leader, Kehoe and me, Vescovo and Todd, got together, decided how we're going to do it, and we were going to let the noise be where it happens and go where it goes. And we were going to get with our chairman and do whatever we could, and we took over. And we thought the governor can either sign it or not, and we knew what to do.
Yeah.
We've been there. We had a governor who was a new guy; he barely knew where the restroom was.
So you went from your career is, like I said, with maybe Senator Wasson, and maybe throw in, Senator Cunningham with a little break there. But you went all 16 years. Is the term limit structure that the state has now the best it can be?
Well, I will tell you, you got to send them home sooner or later. Some of these guys, I talked to Jim Matheson about that too. He would like to stay longer, but I think there's a consensus that sooner or later, having new blood is not a bad idea.
Now, 8 and 8 the right number though.
Yeah, I always thought if you have term limits of 16, you got to do it any combination of House and Senate, 16 the House, 16 the Senate, because what you lose good or bad. You lose a lot of institutional knowledge, and you need to have that buffer against a bureaucracy that is entrenched and been there for 20, 30, 40 years, making a difference. What governors, what party, some of those people are going to be in third and fourth, and they're going to make decisions.
Yeah.
And you need to know who they are and what's the history, and also the lobbying corps, because all of a sudden they were all Democrat lobbyists and kumbaya. We took the majority. Switch the light. Now we're all Republican. You need to understand who they are, what they're going, and not that it's all about party, but some of their affiliations. You just need to know the history of it. And I think sometimes that goes away. And there's an old saying around there, they're going to be here longer than you'll be.
Peter Kinder called you a historic figure in Missouri history, accomplishing both, leading both chambers. But he said, more to the point, you could tell any lobbyist no, and you could tell when most bureaucrats were lying.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that's something that you really could only get over time.
Well, yeah, I guess that's a good point, yeah. I mean, you take Kinder.
So Holzman's idea of 16 total in either chamber might be the move.
Well, I wasn't so much opposed to that. I was opposed to resetting the clock and they'd start again.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of money on the sideline that helped pass term limits that'll come in Missouri and these other states and push back on that. I'm not sure term limits. I mean, it passed by, 90-some% of the people? 60? What was it? It was a big majority.
It was popular, yeah.
So, how do you go against that? Leave. That's what I told you when you walked in the door. When you come in, you know when you're going to leave.
Yeah.
So just do what you're going to do, then leave and let somebody else do it. You don't really have all the great ideas. And you're not the slickest, the funniest person that's ever walked in that building.
So 2010, did you ever think about running for Congress?
Never had the opportunity.
It was an open seat.
Yeah, but here, if you're not a Springfield guy, you can't get the muscle to push you over.
You were Speaker of the House, though. That's pretty good muscle, right? If you were going to be able to do it, that might have been the time to do it, right?
Yeah, I never really thought about it. I've been pretty lucky with doors that open, and I was pretty lucky about thinking one or two steps ahead, but that just never really happened. And then, if you think about it, you're going to fly to D.C. and work Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, fly home and work the district. That's a lot of work. You got to really be motivated and do that. I thought I was happy where I was. I couldn't believe I was chair of economic development. Then when I was speaker and pro tem majority, I thought I'd died and went to heaven. I thought I'd really outkick my coverage.
So you run for Senate. We're going to pick up there in segment 3. We'll talk about your time in the Senate and leading the Senate.
Okay.
We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and we're for the Missouri way of life. We're for worrying less about the what-ifs and more about the why-nots. We're for checking off your bucket list and then making a new one. For starting a family, a business, a tradition. And if you find yourself starting over, we're here for that too. We're for building a life in Missouri and then going out and living it. And when it comes to making sure everything you've built is protected, we're for you. We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance.
The Show Me Missouri podcast is brought to you by our friends at HALO, Heartland Area Landowners. HALO is a membership-based organization for folks interested in farming the sun and the wind. HALO members are passionate about their land, our world, and stewarding the resources that feed America, power, and its economy. Farming the sun and wind has incredible benefits for farmers, landowners, and all Missouri communities, all while helping secure America's energy independence. To learn more about HALO and how you can get involved, visit heartlandowners.farm. That's heartlandowners.farm.